Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. It's been a busy last few weeks that we here at The Final Straw have chosen to take a hiatus. Murderous cops have been acquitted in New York City and Ferguson, Missouri, leading to demonstrations in hundreds of cities across the country, and riots and mass disturbances in a few large coastal cities continue. The students in Mexico who were disappeared by narcos and a local government, redundant much, have finally been announced dead by the government in a way of de-escalating the crowds gathered and blocking commerce and burning buildings around Mexico. In fact, some of the remains that were chopped and burned near Ayotzinapa and Guerrero have been identified as matching the missing Norma Lisa students. This has simply further inflamed the rage of the public against the government, which simply wants people to move on and let business flow as usual, and has said as much. Many parts of Europe, but Greece in particular, has seen solidarity actions and riots in support of anarchist prisoner Nikos Ramos, who conducted a 31-day-long hunger strike in protest of his denial of off-site educational opportunities, a right given to almost all other prisoners in Greece. During the hunger strike, Nikos was hospitalized, and his struggle was joined by his comrades Yanis Mikialides, Andreas Borzoukos Dimitris, and Dimitris Politis. Nikos Ramos is a member of the informal anarchist federation. Needless to say, the encroachment of capitalism, patriarchy, civilization, xenophobia, ecocide, continue to spread their nasty, dirty, icky, greasy fingers as we here take a break. But likewise, so spread the activities of resistance. Minds awakened, hope, like fire, rekindled, wounds healed, and spirits rise to the challenge of taking back one's world and the destruction of that which suppresses and attempts to tame the wildness of the world. Ow! So, dear listeners, find solace in this. We'll return with new programming in the near future. For now, we invite you to enjoy another from the archives, a 2012 conversation with Dean Spade about his book, Normal Life. Enjoy. Followed by punk and metal tracks by such performers as Oblivionation, Youth Avoiders, Enablers, and Scafe. This week, we'll be speaking with Dean Spade. Dean Spade is an attorney, educator, and trans activist. He's taught classes at CUNY, Seattle University, Columbia, and Harvard. In 2002, he founded the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, a collective that provides free legal services and works to build trans resistance rooted in racial and economic justice. Dean Spade is also the author of a new book, Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of Law, just out from South End Press. Normal Life is a finalist for the 2012 Lambda Literary Awards. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Spade.
Thank you.
Your book, Normal Life, centers on a critique of taking an individual rights approach to addressing the nexus of systems of power, such as racism, classism, patriarchy, transphobia, ableism, and immigration status, that, as you say, limit life opportunities of, in particular, folks who don't fall into the gender binary considered the norm in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences as a lawyer, activist, and trans person that brought you to this critique?
I mean, I guess one of the, there's a lot of different things, so it's hard to know where to start, but I guess, you know, a lot of this book comes out of my experiences working at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in New York City, and that organization provides free legal help to people who are low income or people of color who are struggling with discrimination and violence and harm in a wide variety of systems because they're trans or gender nonconforming or intersex. And doing that work, it's just so excruciatingly obvious and heartbreaking and devastating the ways that these sort of like massive systems, like criminalization systems and immigration enforcement systems and welfare systems and shelter systems, operate in the lives of people to control them and to, you know, limit their life chances and to basically end their lives early, and sort of all the ways these systems are operating. And being, you know, living in the United States, the way that the story about discrimination works is it's this imagination. You imagine this bad person, the racist, and a homophobe, this individual who says, you can't live here because you have this identity, or you can't work here. And that is so not enough for understanding the kinds of things that folks endure, and I think that, you know, a lot of us can relate to that, right? That oftentimes there isn't like a single individual bad guy behind a complex and incredibly dangerous and life-threatening and violent set of circumstances that cause both individuals and whole communities to not get what they need, right? To like have the worst schools or to have the worst access to groceries or to be living next to the most toxic factories. And you're not always going to find that one bad perpetrator. So for me, it's been really useful over the years actually to engage with critical race theory, which is a body of scholarship and an intellectual tradition that's theorized, among other things, why anti-discrimination law, which supposedly has been on the books, saying that it's not okay to discriminate against people of color for several decades, hasn't ended racism, right? It's an important dilemma to say that we live in the United States where supposedly we've all been declared equal, and yet there is a really, really, really persistent racial wealth divide, and the evidence of white supremacy is everywhere. And so critical race theorists have been thinking about that. Like, what is it that the law misunderstands about how racism itself works that makes it ineffective at eliminating racism? Why haven't we seen the changes that people might have hoped would come from civil rights law? And I think part of that for me is understanding that anti-discrimination law is really obsessed with the idea of the bad perpetrator, and that's just not enough for understanding how entire systems that are, you know, fundamental systems of U.S. governance and that create the United States as a place itself and as a country, systems like immigration systems, criminal systems, systems of social welfare, are fundamentally structured around race and gender and ability and indigeneity and structure certain populations to be targets of, you know, early death, basically. So I think that for me, working as an advocate in those systems and also just as a person living here and experiencing throughout my own life various aspects of these systems at various times, you know, it becomes clear that it's not about, like, we could just find all the racists and sue them or lock them up, then we would get rid of the system. It's actually much more complicated how systems like white supremacy or systems like transphobia or homophobia or patriarchy work, and that kind of mythology of the perpetrator kind of lets off the hook the opportunity to actually interrogate what is endangering people in our community so severely.
Can you talk a little bit about neoliberalism and the individual rights model? This usage of neoliberalism may not be something that many people are familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word neoliberalism is used to talk about a lot of different aspects of contemporary politics and economic policy and culture. I think that how I'm trying to use it is to think about how a few things. So one is that I really appreciate one of the ways that Lisa Dugan talks about neoliberalism. She says that it's the upward, we can think about it as a set of things that are creating an upward distribution of wealth. And so in the period that we think of as the period of neoliberal economic policy and neoliberalism more broadly, we see what, you know, the Occupy movement has called, right, like a sort of growing wealth gap, this whole analysis around the 99% and the 1%, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and of course, we know that's heavily racialized and gendered. So if neoliberalism is this set of trends in economic policy, trends in privatization, trends in you know, the reduction of mechanisms of democracy in all kinds of ways, trends in global permanent warfare, trends in growing criminal punishment, trends in growing immigration enforcement. If we see that set of things as maybe the conditions of neoliberalism, and they're producing an upward distribution of wealth, and I think also you know, an incredible amount of like violence and danger and death for people on the bottom of that, that, to me, it's really important to analyze how, while the U.S. is experiencing that set of conditions, so especially in the last 40 or 50 years when we've seen those trends really taking hold, especially the massive growth of the criminal punishment system, the massive increase in immigration enforcement, you know, massive increase in privatization, things like that, it has also been the period when supposedly in the U.S. we all became equal, right? So one of the things that's really a complicated contradiction that we're living through is that, you know, the sort of period when supposedly the, you know, bad old days of racism and sexism and ableism in the U.S. were supposedly resolved by civil rights law is also a period when conditions actually worsened for the populations that are supposedly protected by those laws. And so I think that in the context of the conditions of neoliberalism, it's been really important for U.S. culture to portray that there are a few bad people out there who are racists or who are sexist, and that those people are the problem, because it's been essential to portray the broader systems that are actually wildly racially targeted and sexist and ableist as neutral, right? So to say, oh, the economy is totally neutral. It's just a scientific thing that happens. Don't worry about it too much. And you know, this is a place of racial equality and where, you know, ableism has been resolved by anti-discrimination law and sexism. Meanwhile, things get worse and worse for people of color, people with disabilities, poor people, women, right? So I think that that part of what I want us to think about is how one of the features of neoliberalism has been the rise in popularity of the discrimination model that makes us look for some individual perpetrators of you know, racist harm or homophobic harm or whatever it is, that distract us from the reality of sort of these broad-based systems that are producing the really enormous harm and violence against communities of color, people with disabilities, women, queer and trans people, immigrants, et cetera. So that's, I think that's part of the tie-in, is like, how does this narrative about individual rights and individual harm operate as part of the broader constellation of neoliberalism in order to maintain a fiction that that perpetuates sort of this upward distribution of wealth.
So the weakness of the individual rights power model is pretty well broken down by Foucault, which influenced your viewpoint. How can activists perceive of power in such a way as to address how it operates and really sketch out how it disperses?
Yeah. Well, so part of it, right, is like, what, I mean, this is obvious from what I was just saying, but like, we put these mechanisms supposedly in place where you can punish that landlord or that employer if they discriminate against you, and we haven't seen it work. Like, it's basically impossible to prove that kind of discrimination in court. So part of it is just recognizing the ways in which those systems are set up in U.S. law to fail and to not work, and, you know, untold numbers of pages have been written about how we could possibly get anti-discrimination law cases to actually, you know, be meaningful. Like, how could we actually get people to be able to make claims and be heard by courts and win? And it's, in my view, it helps for us to stand back and say, this thing was designed to not work to actually get to the root causes of racism or sexism or homophobia or ableism, and instead to see, to use Foucault to understand that that story about power, that power is about, you know, people on high, you know, forbidding us to do things or excluding us, and then we just need to get them to include us, or we need to punish them for excluding us. That's what's going to resolve it. Really misses a more complex understanding of power that lets us think differently about also how our resistance should look, and also helps us even just understand why this sort of prohibitions on discrimination haven't succeeded, or why things like hate crimes laws haven't succeeded in changing people's life circumstances. So a lot of what I spend time talking about in the book, and I, you know, I really tried to use Foucault's ideas, but really talk about them in a way that's really easily understandable by people from different levels of engagement with theory. So people who don't need to be Foucault scholars to read this book, that was one of my hope for it, even though I am heavily influenced by his ideas. So I tried to do like a kind of quick and dirty with it. And the way that I talked about it, ultimately I'm really talking about his ideas of governmentality and biopolitics, but the way I talked about it in the book is thinking about it in terms of population management power, so that when we get really obsessed with, you know, the sort of power of an individual to exclude another individual, we miss some of the most significant areas where people are experiencing high levels of you know, vulnerability to racism, ableism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, et cetera. And so I want us to think about systems that manage populations, that say, who are the good, right people who should live here and be well and have access to health care and, you know, have proper immigration documentation and, you know, get to go to school and, you know, get to be the people that the government sees as our people, and who are the people who are constructed as the internal enemies, who are drains on our nation and who are a threat to our you know, our population, right? That sort of idea. And so in the U.S., we consistently see the production of these racialized enemies, right? So whether it's the way the drug war produced the image of black criminality that has really justified this drastic, dramatic expansion of criminal punishment that targets black people, and more people than that as well, but heavily targets black people because that's the way it's constructed, especially, or whether it's the way that social welfare programs have been cut by the production of this mythology about quote-unquote welfare queens. That's a heavily racialized and gendered mythology in the United States that that justifies anti-poor policy, or whether it's the production of the war on terror that invents, mobilizes racism and Islamophobia to invent this enemy that justifies this drastic expansion of surveillance and drastic lockdown of borders. These are all moments where we see sort of population management happening, where entire programs are created that aren't about targeting one individual. They're about targeting entire swaths, entire populations. And they often scoop in a bunch of people that they didn't intend to also, right? Like, and that's okay with these programs, right? So the drug war is obviously a fundamentally racist, anti-black set of programs that include pieces of education policy and pieces of housing policy and obviously lots of pieces of criminal policy and immigration policy. And it's targeted at black people, but it's happy to scoop in lots and lots and lots of other kinds of people as well, poor white people and other people of color, and lots of people get caught up in it, but it's crafted in ways that make sure that it most intensely impacts black communities and most intensely impacts poor people, right? The targeting of welfare programs doesn't only end up targeting people who are imagined as the welfare queen, which is black single moms. It also ends up harming lots and lots of other kinds of people who seek and need benefits, but it mostly and most intensely targets and reaches those people. So part of this for me is trying to help us figure out how to discern how power is operating so that we don't believe the lie that something is only racist when it only hurts, the individual person of color who was targeted and who the perpetrator had in their mind, right? So moving away from that way of thinking about power, you excluded me because of this, and you wrote it on the face of the program. You said, this is to target trans people, or this is to target Latinos, or this, right, something like that. That's not the way it operates, right? It operates in this much more complex method where these programs that on their face are racially neutral, right? They don't say that the laws and policies that are governing the war on terror or the war on drugs don't say on them, this is to get people of color, but it does that, right? So part of what I'm trying to do in the book is help people think about power differently and help people stop thinking about what the law says about itself and instead what the law does, and to pick our targets around trying to dismantle harmful systems that are devouring our communities rather than trying to pick our targets to get the law to say good things about us and hope that that's going to change our lives.
A great deal of your book, A Normal Life, is a critique of the nonprofit sector and the energy that goes into it. You've also said that since the liberation struggles of the 1960s and 70s, the nonprofit industrial complex has, whether on their own or by state proxy, co-opted trajectories of liberation and reimagined it to fit within the frameworks of power, turning a conflict into a dialogue and leading to no real changes. What was going on in these liberation movements in the 1960s and 70s? What language was used? And can we learn from these movements, or has power moved on to such a degree that they simply serve as history?
In Normal Life, I was really heavily influenced by this book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, that was published a few years back and edited by and put together by Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. And the book was really transformative for me, and I think for lots and lots of people and many movements, because it really, it's an anthology, and it's a collection of pieces that are analyzing how the rise of the nonprofit form, especially in the last 30, 40 years or so, has shifted what social movement activism demands and how it's shaped and how it looks on the ground. Especially the sort of shift from movements and movement organizations that operated primarily, more seeking to, mobilize large swaths of people affected by particular issues. So thinking about groups like the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, the Farm Workers Movement, even thinking about, the way the Montgomery bus boycott worked, right, this idea of mobilizing large groups of people to disrupt systems that are harming them, to work together, to build people's leadership, to build deep relationships across a broad community, and how that sort of shifted, especially in the 80s, 90s, and onward, towards the creation of organizations that are run in a very hierarchical, business-like manner with, like, an executive director at the top, really significant power of a board of directors who's often, primarily philanthropists and wealthy people, and with organizations heavily reliant on government funding and foundation funding that can sort of shape what the organization can get funded to do, and so shapes and controls the content of social movement organizations. So a lot of the critique has been about the ways that that has shifted the work on the ground from having really deep transformative demands to get to the root causes of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, et cetera. Instead, it's become sort of what you can get funded to do is to do, to change a policy or change a law or try to get something in the corporate media, like sort of elite strategies that are often change the window dressings of existing systems, but don't necessarily get to the root causes of transforming the experiences of communities. And so people see the rise of what people call the nonprofit industrial complex as a one of the important features of this sort of period, this neoliberal period, that has contained and limited activism. And I think it's important to know that while this is sort of the most visible, where a lot of people in the United States who are not part of grassroots movement, all they know is like that there's some nonprofit organization, or they get to the United Way, or they, something like that. It's not all that's gone on. It's not ever been all that's going on in the United States, right? Like, even though that has really risen, and even though there's been drastic attacks on more transformative grassroots organizations, especially, obviously COINTELPRO really sought to dismantle, the FBI sought to dismantle, infiltrate, assassinate, incarcerate leaders and organizations. And that obviously has been a huge blow for our movement. Nonetheless, throughout this whole period, grassroots work centered in mobilizing directly affected communities, centered in racial and economic justice, using horizontal and collective structures has never stopped. So I think that's important for us to know, but a lot of people, I think especially a lot of young activists, students of mine, et cetera, just don't even know about it. Like, that history and that contemporary reality is often erased, and people think that my only option for being involved in social justice is to try to get a job at a nonprofit to go, quote-unquote, help people, right? So this sort of very paternalistic, often very colonial model where people with, higher degrees are going to go to harmed communities and offer their huge wisdom, right? So it's really, I think, a central task of movements right now to identify that nonprofitization trap and the professionalization trap, and to really cultivate and explore and continue experimenting with modes of organizing that are horizontal, that are collective, that are based in a theory of change of mass mobilization, not a theory that if we could just pass the right law or get the right, article in the New York Times, we would win our liberation, because that's just absolutely, never been the way it works, and it's not the way it works now. And I think a lot of people have been really excited, honestly, by the decolonized Occupy encampments in various cities in the last year, because they are publicly utilizing consensus decision-making models and horizontal models of organizing that a lot of people have never seen before. Obviously, these things are as old as dirt, but a lot of people haven't been exposed to them because the hierarchical, nonprofitized, professionalized model is so visible right now. So I think that, for all the complexities of the Occupy and decolonized spaces, one of their real achievements has been introducing a lot of people to what it means to try to organize in, autonomous, horizontal, non-professional ways, and sort of different demands that can come out of those kinds of spaces.
During the last month, Barack Obama and Joe Biden both made statements in support of same-sex marriage. During the same period, the state that I'm broadcasting from, North Carolina, put up to voters and passed a law further banning gay marriage and domestic partnerships. Obama and Biden's support has been much lauded by the mainstream gay and lesbian nonprofits and press. Can we talk about the limits of demands such as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, hate crimes, and same-sex marriage? Who's left behind by these normalized demands?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that the gay and lesbian rights formation is a really good example of a chance to look at the move towards professionalism and nonprofitization and how it's changed and altered and, I think, harmed and weakened the broader social movement for queer and trans liberation. So one way a lot of people talk about this is to think about sort of what the differences might look like between what the public agenda was of queer and trans politics in sort of the 60s and 70s to what it is now, right? So a lot of people see early incendiary moments of queer and trans liberation struggles as being, you know, the Compton Cafeteria riots and the Stonewall Rebellion, right? The sort of late 60s period where communities all over the United States, especially communities of color, are mobilizing against police violence and police brutality, where people are mobilized against the war in Vietnam and are making connections between domestic police violence and the role of the U.S. all over the world engaging in racist violence. And where there's just kind of a, you know, obviously a really growing feminist consciousness where people are critiquing, in a lot of different movements, family formation norms, the use of marriage as a tool of social control, against people of color and against poor people and women. This is sort of the moment in which you see this particular set of sparks around, queer and trans liberation. And it was very, very focused on police violence and very much tied and overlapping with other movements against, you know, militarism, against, you know, family formation norms and gender norms being enforced by the government. It's pretty wild to see the difference between that kind of agenda and the agenda of today's, you know, most visible, most well-funded gay and lesbian rights formation, which is one that seeks entrance into military, into marriage and into criminal punishment by having, you know, hate crimes laws to enhance punishment of people who kill people for being queer or trans. So it's a pretty, like, big, you know, absolute mirror or reversal, or you might say shadow side of the potential demands that were emerging in the 60s and 70s. I would argue, of course, that those demands, an anti-criminalization set of demands, the set of demands that are against militarism and warfare, and a set of demands that are feminist and against the family formation norms and gender norms have continued in queer and trans politics for sure. But certainly this other gay and lesbian rights politics became more visible. And that politics has been very much a politics of non-profitization, where wealthy, mostly wealthy, white, professionalized gay and lesbian leaders, many of them lawyers or other people with higher ed degrees, became leaders in some key nonprofits, Human Rights Campaign, LGBT, these groups that emerged in the 80s and 90s, and really established an agenda that has centered inclusion into violent and harmful institutions in U.S. government and law, rather than dismantling of those institutions. And so marriage is one example of that. And, of course, there's a lot of reasons why that agenda is most appealing to people who have the most to benefit from the private property regimes that marriage upholds, right? So if you have, you know, health insurance through your job, then marriage will help you share it with your partner, but less and less people in the United States have that kind of job, right? And certainly white people are more likely to have a job that has those kind of benefits, wealthy people, educated people, non-immigrants, et cetera, right? If you have immigration status, it's great if you can share it with your partner, right? But most people who are undocumented queer and trans people in the United States don't have a partner who has immigration status, and so marriage isn't going to do anything for them, right? If you have wealth, then you really maybe want to maintain that wealth and make sure that your partner can inherit it. But if you don't have any wealth and you're concerned about the distribution of wealth in the United States, you might actually wish we could abolish inheritance so that we could move towards ending poverty, right? So I think there's, like, very different kinds of interests that would make people see marriage as an answer to the problems of queer and trans people, depending on your positionality and what aspects of homophobia and transphobia are affecting you. And in my experience, the more people are under the, like, most extreme forms of state violence and poverty, the less they have to gain from marriage. And that's partly why we see consistently that people in the United States are less likely to marry if they're poor. And many groups of people of color are also less likely to marry, because literally the benefits of it are most connected to wealth and immigration status and other things like that. So I think a lot of us are fighting to try to center a queer and trans politics that wants to disentangle marriage from well-being, that says, you know, actually we're against the rights, family values rhetoric that says everybody should try to get married and that should be the way we address poverty. We think that's bold and any wish that hasn't worked We know that is fundamentally sexist and racist, and we really want to build a queer and trans politics that demands that everybody gets what they need, regardless of whether or not they enter the state's favored family formation. And that is a real tension, and it's been a giant tension in queer and trans politics, especially because then that politics, that marriage-seeking politics, has produced these enormous backlashes, which do produce huge amounts of homophobia and transphobia in various states. We see that with Prop 8, and we see that with what happened in North Carolina, and I've been really inspired by groups like Southerners and on New Ground. I don't know if you saw their video they put out on YouTube, but they put out a video about what it's been like to fight against the legislation in North Carolina, and really talking about how even if we don't privilege marriage, we can use this as an opportunity to come together and build multiracial, cross-class communities, opposing homophobia and centering real demands for social justice. And I think that I'm really moved by racial and economic justice-centered organizations like Song that don't prioritize marriage, but that are living in states where they have to deal with the backlash that's produced by the marriage efforts. And they're really sort of taking this political opportunity and saying, we can use every opportunity to build the kind of politics, the kind of world we want to live in. And I think they've done a great job of that in the face of some really unfortunate circumstances.
How do you see the prison abolitionist movement developing in the United States? What solutions does it offer in light of the argument that the individual rights model actually entrenches systemic inequalities?
So I think one of the most amazing tools that abolition provides activists and thinkers and people is an understanding of how things that are packaged as reform efforts often just build or legitimize really harmful and violent institutions. So abolitionists have helped us understand that oftentimes the work of prison reform is about building more prisons, right? It's often like, oh, prisons aren't that great for women. Let's build special, gentle prisons with curtains for women where they can have their children with them, right? Like that oftentimes, because what the system of imprisonment wants to do is just grow and grow and imprison more and more people, and there's lots of things driving that, like the privatized prison corporations and the guards unions, and politicians who will want to see their tough on crime and the, the wild huge mobilization of images centered in white supremacy that help sort of fuel people's desire to see that kind of punishment and to believe that they'll be safer when more people are locked in cages, specifically black people. That sort of monster of prison growth will utilize reform consistently as a way to continue to grow. And that what prison abolition helps us do is sort of say, is that thing that's saying it's for our own good, that's saying it's going to make the prison better for women or better for trans people, is that thing actually good for us? Or is that, a rainbow flag wrapped around a cage that they're going to put people in, right? And if you build it, they'll fill it, right? And so prison abolition, that tool to me is really, it's obviously wildly meaningful for all of us right now because we live in the most imprisoning country in the world and the most imprisoning country that's ever existed. And a lot of people are seeing how utterly harmful that is and how prisons destroy communities and ruin people's lives and are wildly racially targeted and just it's an inexcusable, horrendous nightmare of violence. A lot of people see that, right? But I think it's also useful, I think, especially right now for queer and trans people to engage in this kind of discernment about reform that prison abolition helps us engage in by seeing that lots of times a pretend feminist or a pretend anti-homophobic logic will be wrapped around something that's actually really harmful to us. So we can see how there's been, this absurd rhetoric since the beginning of the war in Afghanistan that somehow the U.S., carpet bombing in Afghanistan is going to somehow help Afghan women, right? Or we see this weird logic that pops up that somehow because Iran has homophobic policies, that's the reason we should go to war with them, as if it'd be anti-homophobic to go to war with Iran. And we certainly see this whole pinkwashing campaign from Israel saying, Israel is this wonderful place for gay people, so this justifies our, nightmarish genocidal occupation and theft of all this land from Palestinian people. So I think queer and trans people right now in the United States really, 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 really need this tool of being able to see that often a tank or a cop or a soldier or an apartheid wall or, a checkpoint will be wrapped in a rainbow flag or will be told that it's a feminist project. And we really need to not be tricked into that and in order to, it's a bit of a complex thought process because it's a pretty good trick for us, especially since we were raised in a culture that tells us all you want is for the law to name you or for the government to say, hey, we like you, even if that changes absolutely nothing about your lives and we go on targeting you and killing you, that you know, we shall be seeking to get this kind of declaration. And so right now they're offering us tons of declarations in order to justify continuing to expand projects of U.S. imperialism, of criminal punishment, other things that actually are so wildly harmful to queer and trans people and to women. And so I think this is a really key moment for us to use the kind of discernment that I think abolition politics and abolition scholarship and activism has grown in a lot of people. I think increasingly a lot of queer and trans people I know in the U.S. have a critique of hate crimes laws. They see that hate crimes laws don't save our lives and that they just build resources for law enforcement and that law enforcement is the number one perpetrator of quote-unquote hate crimes against queer and trans people. So a lot of people are seeing that one. Like, that's the one I think a lot of people have grasped. Like, oh, yeah, this thing does nothing for us. It just builds a thing that targets us. And I think we can use, and that to me is a kind of abolitionist discernment, if we can use that around other systems. So we can see, oh, the nature of this thing is it's a cage, or the nature of policing is that it's racist. We can't reform policing to not make it racist. It is racist. That's what cops will always do. We can't fire all the racist cops or find them. No, that's the entire culture policing, the entire system policing is racist. And so I think the more we can do that, if we can have that discernment about the military has not become anti-homophobic because they're supposedly letting gay and lesbian people serve. Right. So I guess I'm especially thinking that we need the kind of discernment abolition has provided to us to critique reforms that supposedly operate to protect us when really they're reforming and expanding and building systems that that are our biggest opponents.
As an abolitionist, how would you address demands for justice around the murder of Trayvon Martin, since those demands mostly came in the form of calls for using the same prison industrial complex to punish Zimmerman that worked to perpetuate criminalization of young black men like Trayvon?
Yeah, I mean, as an abolitionist, I definitely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in prosecution or imprisonment of anyone, and I think what's interesting about this case is that the reason people are so pissed about it is not because of just this one victim and this one perpetrator, but because this happens all the time. Like, that's why people are so pissed, is because black life is utterly devalued by the criminal punishment system and white life is valued, right? And, like, that's why, and because so many other young black men have died at the hands of the police and vigilantes, and because, like, the level of violence against black people is so wild, and so it's really not about Zimmerman, right? It's about this whole set of systems that value some forms of life and extinguish others. And so for me, what's been most important, and we know that even if they lock up Zimmerman forever, this is still going to happen in 2 months, in 4 months, whatever. So another Oscar Grant, another, you know, whoever it's going to be, Amadou Diallo, et cetera. And so to me, I don't think always it's useful to critique people's signs or things like that at marches for obvious reasons, especially for me. Like, as a white person, I wouldn't show up at a mostly black march and critique people's signs. But I do think finding ways to just bring attention back to the broader system, and so that it's not all about Zimmerman. And this is the same way whenever cops kill people in whatever city I'm in, they kill another person of color, and it becomes all about, like, let's get that cop. And it's like, guess what? They're just going to hire another one. Like, there's something about policing that makes people do this. Whether they're not going to hire the right person ever who's not going to do this. It's going to keep happening as long as we have police. So I think, you know, to me, it's not about criticizing people who have that demand, because emotionally, in our culture, that demand makes a lot of sense, and there's a lot of reasons that it comes up. But instead, just trying to build the other side of the conversation about, like, why, if it's not Zimmerman, it'll be somebody else, and what would it take? What it take to have this never happen again? That's what restorative or transformative justice approaches are about, saying, how can this never happen again, as opposed to how can this one person not do this again? Which it doesn't even, you know, criminal punishment doesn't even achieve that, because, you know, oftentimes people do the same thing again. And so it's criminal punishment. So the restorative or transformative justice are about, what are the conditions that make this possible? Why? How did Zimmerman even become somebody who walks around with these ideas in his head about black people? So what are the deep root causes of that kind of anti-black racism in our culture, and how can we get at that? And then also, what are the deep, you know, features of the criminal punishment system that devalue black life that we also need to root out in order for people to, you know, really be appeased, this real anger people have? It's not just about Zimmerman, right? It's about this whole system. And so I think for me, it's been about, like, just returning to attention to that in various, you know, ways, whether that's, like, writing something publicly, or whether that's doing radio programming about it, or whether that's, you know, having a community group that wants to get to the bottom of of thinking about that systemically, or having an abolitionist, explicitly abolitionist group that wants to work on it together. And so it's not saying that the other work is bad. It's just saying we're going to focus on this work.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Spade.
Thanks.
This week, we've been speaking with Dean Spade. Dean Spade is an attorney, educator, and trans activist. He founded the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, a collective that provides free legal services and works to build trans resistance rooted in racial and economic justice. Dean Spade is also the author of the new book, Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of Law, just out from South End Press. Normal Life is a finalist for the 2012 Lambda Literary Awards.
As to this matter of violence, a technique of violence was first developed in 2 million BC by the Australopithecines, a tribe of 4-foot primates who had no brains to speak of, but who, nevertheless, invented the tomahawk and used it on each other. This practice led to the enlargement of the brain, another useful weapon. Yes, murder was invented even before man began to think. Now, of course, man has become known as the thinking animal.
We just heard Oblivionation from Lowell, Massachusetts, with The Language of Violence from their album of the same name. Next, we'll hear Youth Avoiders with Snake Charmer from their self-titled album.
Let's get started!
You're hearing Phuc Mountain with Dead Air from their album Dead Dogs. And next up is a Milwaukee band, Enabler, with New Life from their album La Fiend Absolue du Monde. Finally, this is Skopje with Melancholic Ossuary from their self-titled album.
Thank you.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.